From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Barack Obama, the senator from Illinois, has won the Democratic caucuses in Iowa. I'm telling you, Keith, history. This is Lexington and Concord. This is going around the world right now. In Rangoon, they're putting their front page together.
MSNBC's Chris Matthews on Thursday night, arguably the opening night, not counting months of previews, of the 2008 presidential race. Expect that show to run for about a year.
A guy named Barack Hussein Obama, whose father's from Kenya, and here he is on a victory projectile to win the Democratic nomination, defeating the president's wife. That's the big story as well. I think the lead here is Barack Obama, and the second lead is Hillary loses.
Mark Jerkowitz is the Associate Director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. Mark, what do you make of the enthusiasm of MSNBC's Chris Matthews?
You took the words right out of my mouth, but I was going to say no one's ever accused Chris Matthews of a lack of enthusiasm. But he reflects, I think, the level of sort of surprisingly decisive commentary that came out of Thursday night's Iowa caucuses. This didn't feel like the first inning of a game. This felt like the ninth inning of a game, the way the media were covering it.
And do you think that was appropriate? Do you think that the media pump up the importance of the Iowa caucus merely because they spend so much time there?
Well, there's a real psychology to this, and recognize that journalists are human. And they finally actually got to see somebody vote. You can only imagine the pent-up anticipation and excitement. So there's going to be a natural, emotional, psychological tendency to play this bigger than maybe it is. Having said that, you had very definitive messages coming out of the press. The first one was there was no weasel words about a limited mandate or anything like that. The victories by Huckabee and Obama were treated as definitive wins. There was a winner and a loser. And then the most problematic message that came out of it was this sense that across the plains of Iowa swept a sweeping prairie fire and mandate of populist change. And here I think you got the most extrapolation and jumping to conclusions that may or may not hold up during the rest of the race.
Much was made on Thursday night about Edwards coming in second and Clinton coming in third, whereas there was barely a point, if that, between them. A lot of discussion of McCain on the Republican side getting 13%, which was not seen as a defeat for him at all. Nobody mentioned Ron Paul's 10%. Are the media still playing favorites when it comes to these candidates? Are they making too much of places beyond first?
I don't think that Hillary Clinton was necessarily being given a demerit for finishing a very, very close third. It wasn't whether she finished third or second, frankly. It was the fact that Obama beat her by a solid margin that made her the loser. Edwards, who finishes second by the narrowest of margins, we found the immediate coverage afterwards to sort of write Edwards out of the story again, other than he'll continue to fight on. It sort of continues a trend that we've had with John Edwards, which is he's tended to, frankly, be ignored by much of the media. On the Republican side, I think there was a lot of talk about this is a very good night for John McCain, which may leave a lot of viewers scratching their heads why he finished fourth or tied for third. He was way, way 20-some points behind Huckabee. How is that a good night? And, of course, there, that's the media already looking forward to Tuesday night in New Hampshire, assuming that McCain's going to have a strong showing there and thinking that the defeat of Romney in Iowa turns out to be a very good thing for McCain. That's some sophisticated tiering that we have to wait and see for a while.
Having watched a lot of the coverage on Thursday night and Friday morning and sampled a bunch of the headlines, what do you think the coverage of the Iowa caucus tells us about what we can expect in the coverage of the rest of the campaign?
When we're looking at newspaper headlines and the immediate aftermath, we see a lot of sort of playing it straight, didn't put a lot of spin on it, but really reinforced the sense that there were huge winners coming out of Iowa. The lesson from the cable networks is they are managing to get their arms around – they managed to get their arms around the tricky prospect of both vote counting and projection. I sort of anticipated a night that would go on till 11 o'clock and 12 o'clock, and the projections and the predictions were in much earlier than that. So my guess is that TV will be determined to make sure there's very little suspense on any night when people are casting votes from here through November.
You were saying that, as far as you could see, the newspaper headlines mostly played it straight. That's a little depressing. No fun tabloids on this?
It was a little depressing. We got a couple of sort of winds of change. But I will give you my personal nomination for best headline this morning. It's the Boston Herald, which until recently you could argue was Mitt Romney's hometown newspaper. It's the conservative tabloid in Boston. And they have almost a full-page headshot of Mike Huckabee, who does bear maybe a distant resemblance to Jim Nabors, who once starred in a very funny show called Gomer Pyle. So the Boston Herald has a big picture of Huckabee with the headline, Shazam, Gomer Huckabee Whips Slick Mitt. So not only do you get an aged baby boomer pop culture reference, but you also learn that even when voters in Iowa are casting the votes, in Boston, all politics is local.
Thank you so much, Mark.
You're welcome.
Mark Jerkowitz is the Associate Director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism.
In the wake of the Iowa caucuses, the political forecast may still be fuzzy, but the financials tell a clearer story. In the final weeks of the campaigning, the candidates spent three times as much as in 2004 on TV and internet advertising. Professor Bruce Gronbeck, who teaches television and political rhetoric at the University of Iowa, has been watching that massive ad buy. He says that the record-breaking spending in Iowa is due to the compressed primary schedule. As more states scheduled votes closer and closer together, there was mounting pressure to get a running start in Iowa, a challenge the candidates confronted by inundating the state with ads for almost a year.
So I think the strategy of moving places like California, New York, Illinois, Florida, and Michigan forward caused Iowans to experience just an awful lot more ads than they ever have.
One thing I've noticed is an almost total absence of attack ads. It's been pretty gentle, hasn't it?
Yeah, but that's, I think, typical of the early caucuses and primaries. The Ronald Reagan 11th commandment of not speaking ill of one's brethren in the party sits kind of there. And it's especially true in Iowa when Pat Buchanan got really nasty on immigration issues in 96. He went sliding down the polls. Steve Forbes even tried relatively quiet comparison ads between himself and Bob Dole, but he too made no progress whatsoever with those ads. Iowans don't especially like the negative attack ads. Even in the senatorial races, when they've gotten nasty, you tend to have people even pull out of the electorate and decide not to participate.
Well, then how has the public responded, for example, to Mitt Romney's commercial comparing his record on immigration to Mike Huckabee's, which, you know, makes him seem like he's opening the floodgates to Mexico and points south?
I think Romney suffered for it. And, of course, he took an even harder punch from Huckabee and the rest of the candidates when he went after John McCain.
What about the 527s, the groups outside of official campaigns who are free to spend money on supposed issue advertising, but also give rise to things like the swift boating of John Kerry? Have they been active?
They have been active. The one we've seen the most is the Alliance for a New America, which has been supporting John Edwards by going after his opponents. The others have asked him to disavow the group, and he says, well, I can't call them. That'll be illegal for me in a political campaign. Governor Huckabee has been beaten on by the Club for Growth, a group that's going after his tax policies. And Obama insists that he's had $3.2 million worth of ads attacking him. Anyway, they're big figures. They came in the late fall in November, December, and they're getting their knives sharpened.
Now, what about the internet? This was supposed to be the year when the internet began to take over television's traditional impact in these elections, but more money has been spent on Des Moines TV airtime than ever before in history. How influential has internet advertising been to your mind?
Well, of course, the internet started long before anything on television, even before candidates got themselves declared. It began last fall on the positive side, with the by now famous Obama girl singing her love to Barack Obama. And that, I checked this morning, had 4.6 million hits. It gets watched a lot. The Hillary 1984, the attack on Hillary using the old Mac ad, but putting her in the place of Big Brother, has had almost as many hits, 4.5 million. And, of course, then just the whole world of blogs. Anytime Ron Paul was mentioned anywhere, an army of bloggers would sit and kick it on to another source, to another blog, or to one of the news organizations so that he'd get a phenomenal number of hits for anything that he said anywhere.
Now, I'm speaking to you on Thursday when the caucuses take place. And we're not talking about primaries where someone just goes in and yanks a lever. People meet in gymnasiums and so forth and actually discuss candidates and so forth. You are leading one of these caucuses this evening. Will these subjects come up about websites and 527 attacks and so forth?
What you'll see, I think, most interestingly in the talk is not necessarily identifying a particular medium, but you'll hear phrases from the ads. You know, the talk of Hillary as the experienced candidate, the Obama theme throughout 2007 of faith and hope, and the Edwards populist messages of attacking large, powerful interests in the country. Those will be in those conversations.
I want to ask you one last thing. Historically, has there been any correlation between the amount of money spent on TV by a candidate and how well he or she has fared in the caucuses?
It's very much a mixed bag. Because big spenders, for example, Steve Forbes in 1996, went absolutely nowhere. It's mixed enough so that I don't think there are any rules. I think that heavy spending, as I say, in many ways, is one, being aimed at the media, of course, so that they will report these kinds of things and circulate them to other states. Secondly, to allow candidates to actually build their ads here and have them in the can, because they're going to have to blitz those large states in a hurry.
All right, Professor, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Bruce Gronbeck teaches television and political rhetoric at the University of Iowa. Coming up, if you are what you eat, I can't even pronounce your name.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. No one knows who killed Benazir Bhutto, the head of Pakistan's largest political faction, the Pakistan People's Party. No one knows what will happen in next month's elections, delayed for 6 weeks by her assassination. Another unknown is how she will be remembered. Was she the photogenic, fearless first female leader of a Muslim nation who heroically inherited her father's legacy and his tragic fate? Or was she a corrupt politician, so widely criticized that she had to broker her return to Pakistan to avoid being arrested upon entering the country? The Pakistani press is struggling with all these questions. The Christian Science Monitor's Shahan Mufti says that since Bhutto's assassination, the domestic press has largely avoided the ugliness of her past.
Within hours, she was being referred to as Shahid Bhutto, which means Bhutto the Martyr, which was actually a title held by her father. There was a profound sense of mourning on the television and in the print press. It seemed like the media was mourning Benazir Bhutto along with the rest of the nation.
So you've described the kind of emotional reaction, the perfectly logically emotional reaction to her murder. But I'm wondering what stories about Bhutto in these very tense times in Pakistan went unreported.
The press hasn't come to a place yet where it can pull back and coldly analyze Benazir Bhutto's political career and her recent political moves. This is something that Benazir Bhutto's party, the Pakistan People's Party, is definitely trying to capitalize on. That is part of why the Pakistan People's Party was putting immense pressure on the government to hold the elections this coming week and not delay them. Many were counting on what's been called a sympathy vote.
The party has announced that it will be led by Bhutto's widower, Asif Zardari, and her son Bilawal, who is a teenager. He's a 19-year-old, and her husband was a crook. How has this news been received by the Pakistani people, and how has it played in the press?
Again, we're talking about a period right after Benazir Bhutto's death when not many people seem to be questioning this. The naming of Bilawal Bhutto, Bilawal Zardari, whose name has suddenly been changed to Bilawal Bhutto Zardari, is a teenager. Like you said, he's at Oxford University, a big fan of Facebook. A lot of the information coming out about him is coming out of Facebook right now. The Pakistan People's Party, it is the largest, and the strongest political party in the country. And there might be questions asked in the press and by within the party, really, of why the reins of the party are going to the husband, who is, like you said, has a reputation for being one of the most corrupt political leaders the country has seen, and her teenage son, who hasn't lived in the country for the good part of his life and who still is not in the country.
If it is true, as Pervez Musharraf has alleged, that this was an operation by al-Qaeda elements within the tribal areas of Pakistan, what has been the press reaction to it?
President Pervez Musharraf addressed the nation on Wednesday. He said he had a request for the media to expose militant leaders in the country and thereby support democracy. The press at this time is really caught up in the blame game that is going on in the political circles, where the Pakistan People's Party seems to be blaming Musharraf and his loyalist parties for the assassination, where other parties are pointing fingers at the intelligence outfits. And Pervez Musharraf's appeal to the media is really an attempt to direct attention towards militant elements in this country and how they might be involved.
Are you under any restrictions on what you may report based on either the previous emergency decrees or any subsequent legislation about criticizing the government or the president?
Nothing is very clear. There have been foreign journalists thrown out of this country. As far as the Pakistani media goes, there has been a tempering down any criticism of the armed forces, which can be met with harsh punishment now. Their satire has disappeared from television, and satire was proving to be one of the main tools with which television media was really expressing its frustration with the government. Satire has not been banned, but it essentially can't find its place in the media environment anymore. Of course, this is all in the background of the curbs that were introduced on the media after the emergency. And all the television channels had to sign a code of conduct to come back on air when they were taken off. So it's an uncertain environment right now, and the media isn't sure exactly what the limits on it are.
One of the theories about the assassination is that Musharraf's own intelligence services or elements within them may have cooperated in the assassination. Can domestic reporters actually try to get to the question of whether this was at least partly an inside job?
No news coverage that I have seen has dared go in that direction. Because the media environment, the information environment in this country is so threatened, there is a tendency to resort to conspiracy theories immediately. The government, a few days after Benazir Bhutto's assassination, came out with a press conference in which they gave a theory for her death which seemed ludicrous to many.
The sunroof explanation.
The sunroof explanation, which said that she had hit her head on the lever of a sunroof. The government has since retracted that as the cause of her death. But it is really those kinds of things, and then obviously the limits on the media, that lead people to conspiracy theories, which may or may not be true.
Okay. Shahan, thank you very much for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
Shahan Mufti is a freelance writer based in Islamabad and a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor.
For decades, the consumption of news has complicated our consumption of food. Nowadays, what we buy to eat is determined by shifting health studies. Carbs are good for you. No, they're bad. Fats make you fat. No, they don't. And food labels only increase our confusion. Michael Pollan, journalist and professor of science and environmental journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, has written a new book called In Defense of Food, in which he inveighs against nutritionism, a kind of ideology that sees foods as mere packets of nutrients whose interactions must be interpreted by scientists. And he says we shouldn't allow ourselves to be intimidated by studies or news reports or especially food labeling. Humans can thrive on all sorts of diets. Some live healthy lives on nothing but cattle or seafood. In fact, he says, there's only one diet that has consistently proved hazardous to our health.
Yeah, ours, the Western diet. It's actually, you know, people who have done the sort of ethnographic research around food, have found this astonishing array of different traditional diets on which people have been extremely healthy. But there is one diet that it appears that we are poorly adapted to, and that is what we call the Western diet. And this diet makes people fat and makes them diabetic. It gives them heart disease. It gives them an assortment of cancers. It's just very toxic to our bodies.
You say by the early 80s, the American supermarket underwent a kind of transformation. So, Michael, if I fell asleep in the 40s and woke up in the 80s in an A&P, what would I notice about the food?
You would have noticed that the packages would talk about how much cholesterol or how little cholesterol, how much fat, how much sugar, a whole lot of science. The whole discourse surrounding food underwent a revolution, and that's where we are today. We speak about food as if they are a collection of nutrients, and the nutrients are what matters.
So let's talk about some of the guidance that you do offer in very clear terms. Some of the rules for healthy eating are don't eat anything that doesn't rot, don't eat anything your grandmother wouldn't recognize, don't eat anything that has an unfamiliar, unpronounceable name, don't eat anything with high fructose corn syrup, don't eat food that features health claims on their labels.
Yeah, that might seem a little counterintuitive, but the reason I concluded that health claims should be essentially avoided is by looking at the kinds of products that carry them. You find health claims on processed foods, fruits and vegetables. They don't have the budget. They don't have the packaging. The healthiest food is silent. So the kind of advice I offer is an attempt to bore back through the science to the native wisdom that we once had. Tradition around food is not just turning back the clock. It's the distilled wisdom of the group. I mean, what people eat is the result of generations upon generations of essentially dietary trial and error to figure out what keeps people healthy and happy.
And you suggest that the science or the pseudoscience behind nutritionism is based on very, very little.
The nutrition science on which all these dietary recommendations are based is very well-meaning, but it's also very crude. We may figure this out at some point. We may understand nutrition better, and I'm not saying we should stop doing the science. I'm saying that the media and the consumer should take it all with many, many grains of salt and watch it and be interested in it, but not change your behavior based on the latest nutritional study because it's simply not strong enough as a guide.
And you also talk about the succession of nutrient fads. You know, this season's omega-3 follows last season's oat bran. It seems news consumers can't really find reliable information about how to be food consumers.
Well, I think that that's true. I think that the media has done us a disservice as well by basically over-promoting whatever the newest wrinkle is in these health studies and not examining the quality of the research or reminding us that science is an incremental kind of dialectical process. Small bits of knowledge are advanced and then they're overturned. And that's not an unusual thing, but the media tends to kind of lock everybody into a position. So that's why I worry about these new rating systems that are poised to take over the supermarket. And very soon there'll be these ABC ratings or 1 through 100 helping you distinguish whether the Nilla wafers are better than the Chips Ahoy. What science will those ratings be based on? Will they be based on the old think about dietary fat or the new think about carbohydrates? And what will they do in 5 years when the new think is now the old think?
I wonder, Mike, how self-conscious you were in writing this book. Your book is a warning, a prescription for better eating and health. It's a kind of manifesto. Don't you risk employing the same sorts of tactics as the journalists that you critique?
Yeah, it's always an awkward place to be. But I don't write as an expert. I write as an eater. I write as someone who tried to get to the bottom of what's going on in nutrition science. And I tried very hard to escape this ideology of nutritionism. As much as possible, I'm trying to get eaters to take back the fork, to take back control over their diets, and not be baffled and intimidated and daunted by experts.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Michael Pollan's new book is called In Defense of Food. Adam Drewnowski is one of those nutritional experts who has devised one of those food rating systems that Michael Pollan just referred to. Drewnowski hopes his 100-point system will eventually make its way to supermarkets and that every price tag will be accompanied by a number representing the food's rating or nutrient profile. Similar rating systems are already used in Europe, where future regulations will prevent low-scoring foods from making any positive health claims on the package. American nutritionists have created competing systems. Some, for instance, use letter grades, and large grocery chains have expressed interest in adding one system or another to their shelves sometime soon. Drewnowski agrees that grocery shoppers confront a barrage of health claims that are nearly impossible to weigh against one another.
The point of nutrient profiling is that we do the math for you on a 100-point scale, and they are based on the best science available. I like a 100-point scale better than grades because grades imply judgment. And a 100-point scale is like temperature.
I don't know. As a recipient of many number grades in my life, I still think that they imply judgment. And also, when you talk about you use the best science available, how good is the best science? The conclusions keep changing year by year, decade by decade.
Guilty as charged, I think nutritional science has been changing its mind. And I think that has led to consumer confusion. And that is why the score is based on not what you have been calling the nutrient du jour, but rather on a combination of various nutrients. Let's think in terms of the vitamin B12, the zinc, the magnesium, the potassium, the vitamin C, the vitamin A.
This is what Michael Pollan would call nutritionism, breaking things down into their component parts when that's not how we enjoy food and that's not how our body actually uses them.
Well, I'm not saying that we should be looking at those nutrients separately. I'm saying that we should be looking at all those nutrients together. I agree that previously we were looking at foods in terms of the single nutrient. For example, blueberries, high in antioxidants. Oysters, high in zinc. How about doing a composite goodness score, which takes all of those things into account? But let me mention, I think it has to be personalized for you. I'm looking forward to see a scanner which you scan across the barcode and it reads a specific readout of the healthfulness of a given product for you and you alone. And technology allows us to do that, and this could happen.
But in the meantime, what we'll end up with is a nutrient score that varies probably from grocery store to grocery store, alongside a lot of dubious health claims. Isn't scoring like this only going to add to the confusion?
No, I don't think so. It'll simplify things a great deal. You know, people go and they say, I want to buy cookies. I want to buy cereal. Which of the cereals on the shelf has got the best nutritional value? And can I tell this at a glance? I think the intent was never to compare, you know, I was going to say apples and oranges, but in fact, you can compare apples and oranges because, in fact, they are within the same food category. We're not comparing apples and chickens.
Much earlier in this discussion, you made reference to nutrients du jour. How do these things become du jour?
On the negative side, when it comes to, say, trans fatty acids, there is usually a study in nutritional epidemiology which looks for a statistical correlation between consumption of a given nutrient and health outcomes. This, of course, can be problematic because nutrients are not consumed in a vacuum. Certain people have got certain dietary patterns. Maybe the consumption of that nutrient is linked to the health event, but maybe it's poverty and living in the Bronx, you tell me. Those studies never really make it clear. On the other hand, they are picked up by the media, and this is the devastation du jour, what I call the problem of the day. Years later, this becomes part of the conventional wisdom.
So when we get to the good nutrient du jour, how do we become obsessed with them? And then what does, you know, does the science follow the reporting or does the reporting follow the science?
In many of those cases, I think the research has been commissioned, bought and paid for. For example, the launch of pomegranates as an antioxidant. I'm not saying, of course, that the research was not reliable. I'm merely saying that there are ways of directing attention to a specific nutrient. But I think what's interesting here is this pendulum swinging between sugar and fat and back again. There was clearly no research that directed the media. In fact, I think the media led the research. To my mind, the transition came precisely in February of 1995 when the New York Times published a front page piece by Molly O'Neill saying that pasta can make you fat. And until that point, it was generally recognized that pasta couldn't make you fat because pasta was consumed by athletes preparing for a marathon. And right now, good fats are good for you, and what makes you obese is sugar. So I'm thinking that the pendulum will be swinging back one more time to us blaming fat for human obesity. And I've already seen the first example of that. The Center for Science in the Public Interest recently came out in favor of high fructose corn syrup, saying there was not much wrong with it. And 10 years from now, sugar will be good and fat will be bad again. Mark my words.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Adam Drewnowski is the director of the Nutritional Sciences Program at the University of Washington.
Coming up, tracking the writer's strike for its real-world effects.
And by real-world, we mean advertising. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, offering a new one-year Master of Arts degree program for experienced journalists. Journalism.columbia.edu. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Certain prognosticators, like me, have dined out for several years now, predicting doom for broadcast television in the indeterminate future. But with the Writers Guild of America striking into a third month, no one is quite certain what the small screen will look like in several months, never mind in the years to come.
A Jew, a Christian, and a Muslim walk into a bar. The Jew says to the Muslim, "See, I have no idea what they say because there's a writer's strike. We don't know what they say."
There are, remember, three sides to this story. The Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, in other words, the studios and networks, the writers, and then the advertisers and media buyers who are caught in the middle. Jack Myers, publisher of the Jack Myers Media Business Report and industry newsletter, has written that if the strike stretches into the summer, it may, quote, destroy network television as advertisers know and love it. He joins me now. Jack, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks, Bob. Good to talk with you.
So let's just say this strike extends into June. What happens then?
Well, realistically, Bob, it doesn't even have to go until June. The development season for network television programming is typically right now. The networks would be making their selections from several hundred scripts to determine which they're going to move toward the pilot process. So if it stretches much beyond the middle of January, we're looking at a very high degree of certainty that the traditional network television upfront period, which is May, June, and July, when about 80% of the advertising dollars for primetime television in the 2008-2009 season would be spent, won't happen as it has for the last 60 years.
In that upfront, as it's called, the TV networks have these very elaborate and glitzy showcases. The advertising industry comes to take a look and also at the same time negotiates the biggest part of its buys for the subsequent year. If the stakes are as high as you've described, I'm trying to understand why the studios and the producers are so reluctant to settle, because at least on the face of it, the writers demand that they get a piece of the action for digital distribution of their work, seems quite reasonable.
It does seem reasonable, and it does seem difficult to understand the networks and studios' position, but it's a fairly fundamental one. The writers are asking for a percentage of gross revenues, because in Hollywood, the concept of net revenues has become anathema. There are no net revenues.
Because after the accountants get done with the the income statement, every show, even the biggest hit, runs at a loss.
Exactly. So the writers correctly are asking for a percentage of gross. Whatever deal that might get done by the writers will then be demanded by the Screen Actors Guild and by the Directors Guild when their contracts come up in June. So you can multiply by three and then adding in other issues probably by four. If the networks and studios were to give up 2.5% of gross revenues on digital rights, it would ultimately turn into somewhere between 7.5% and 10%. At this point in time, they don't know what their profits are going to be. They don't know what the incremental distribution costs are going to be. They don't know what their technology costs are going to be. They don't know what their development, sales, and marketing costs are going to be. And they don't know what the revenues are going to be from advertisers. Right now, internet advertising inventory can be bought very, very cheaply. So they're concerned about making a commitment to gross revenues when ultimately what they give up to the unions could conceivably be more than their total profitability.
Now, I want to ask you for a moment about Sarah Fay, whom we both know. She is the CEO of the media buying firm Kara US. And she said that the press has not covered the writer's side of these issues fairly. Do you think she's right about that?
Yes, I think she's right. I think there's a real reluctance on the part of the television writers and several of the business writers whose lifeblood is dependent on the networks and studios to be critical of them and be critical of their negotiating posture. There really hasn't been, in my opinion, fair presentation of the fact that the alliance is simply not coming to the negotiating table. What they're doing is they're falling into their traditional pattern of essentially ignoring you and hoping you'll go away and assuming that the writers will experience more pain than they will and that the writers won't have the stomach to last until the summer.
Jack, thank you so much for joining us.
Bob, it's great to talk to you.
Jack Myers publishes the Jack Myers Media Business Report. He's online at jackmyers.com.
Gordon Bell is a computer scientist with an eye for detail. Every detail, in fact, that he's accumulated over the course of his life. A senior researcher for Microsoft, Bell is at the vanguard of a movement called life logging, digitally storing every letter and photo, every phone call, email, and video, every conversation, keystroke, and scrap of paper, the entire minutia of his daily routine, onto a hard drive. He wears a camera around his neck called a SenseCam that takes snapshots every minute of whatever may be in his path, including you, if you happen to be standing there. Last year, when I spoke with Gordon Bell, who is not a young man, he was in the process of creating a complete virtual memory to supplement his own imperfect one, a defiant Proustian reclamation of lost time that may be changing the very way we think about the past. But why?
Why?
Yeah.
Why does anybody ever preserve anything? Is there any value to having a photograph of my mother at age 3 or so, you know, or a deed that I happen to have that would have been around in a shoebox that came from great-grandparents before 1900? So anything that, in fact, represents information, those things are all put in cyberspace, and those are the things that I think should be in cyberspace. I go further than anybody else, which is to essentially really overtly get rid of anything I can that I can scan, and that includes coffee cups and T-shirts and mugs, you know, things like that where I may want a memory of that.
I suspect this isn't for everyone. I mean, some of us really like to get rid of stuff. They feel the burden of all of life's flotsam and jetsam.
Yeah, that's true. But I've got a kind of a systematic way of getting rid of it. But yet, it's there if you ever will, in fact, want it.
Gordon, do you see your computer as a real extension of your brain these days?
I think I do. I really do. I think of it as offloading a tremendous amount for me and giving it a lot of responsibility.
Could you go back to life before?
Oh, I think I could go back to life before. It's a different life. Frankly, I think of myself a little bit, I'm in an explorer's life right now. I see it as a quest to have an electronic memory that has so much of one's own real memory in it, because I tend to think that everybody is going to be here, you know, at some point in time.
Lifelogger Gordon Bell. Journalist and technology whiz Clive Thompson wrote about Bell and the implications of lifelogging in Fast Company magazine. I asked him what he expected to find when he visited Gordon Bell.
Well, I think I expected that there would be this guy who has, you know, this brain that would give him perfect recall of everything immediately. And I could ask him, who's the person that sat next to you on the plane 3 weeks ago? And, you know, what was the recipe that you cooked 2 years ago for dinner? And that would be this very precise thing, because all the information is there. And it's true, all the information is there, but he hasn't quite figured out how to organize it and sort it perfectly. So although he would sometimes be amazing at recall, like he was talking about a jazz symphony that he saw in Australia, he's trying to describe it and he realizes he doesn't need to describe it. He can just play it for me, you know? So sometimes it was amazing, but a lot of the times he would start to try and find something and then spend 20 minutes trying to find it. And eventually sort of get lost in this buggy software, because it's a new piece of software. It's a demo.
So it's easy to preserve all this raw data,
yes,
but it's extremely hard to lay your hands on exactly the piece you want at that time. But isn't he developing, or aren't other people developing for him, programs to do that? Life Browser, Remembrance Agent, Facet Map?
You know, that's the holy grail quest right now. Like at Microsoft, they have this thing called Facet Map. It's this beautiful sort of graphical interface where you can zoom down on any one thing and it's connected to everything else. Like you could say, okay, show me last Thursday, and it'll show you all the emails he sent and all the documents he looked at and all the websites he looked at. And then you might go, well, let's look at those websites. And you find a website and it might show you all the other days that you access that website. So you can sort of tunnel through your memories in very interesting sort of dreamy ways.
And is it also Facet Map that uses not just days or time periods, but you can also drill down on a person?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Tell me everything about my Aunt Susie that I've stored up.
And that's very useful, because what will happen is you'll think, okay, well, Brooke mentioned this book to me. I can't remember the name of the book. So I'll start by just looking at everything I have that's related to Brooke. And I'll remember that you said that to me, I don't know, a month ago when I was on the show. So I'll look at all the communications I had with you a month ago. And so it actually becomes very quick to find the name of the book, because I find the email or the conversation. It works very well that way, because that's sort of the way our memories work. Psychologists have long discovered that we organize our memories very often based on people and time. And if you put those two things together, you can index the vast majority of your memories very quickly.
So if you want to be able to find this information, you have to sort of replicate what your memory would naturally do.
Yes, exactly.
And you focus quite a bit on the effect that a surrogate brain has on actual carbon-based memory, our physical minds.
Sure, absolutely. Well, I mean, what Gordon has found is that it's changed the way that he decides to remember things and what he decides to remember. And he compares it to doing long division. He could probably remember how to do long division if he really thought about it, but he doesn't need to, because he has pocket calculators. Just think about our behavior with our mobile phones. A lot of people can't remember the phone numbers of their very, very close associates because their phones remember it for them. And they put it in once and they forget it.
Long division we were forced to learn at some point.
That's
so
right.
We have the luxury of forgetting it, but not these phone numbers. Without our cell phones, we're lost.
Right. And actually, in Europe, where their phone really has thousands of phone numbers and emails because it's their central device, there is a huge anxiety about losing your phone or losing the memory on your phone. They have all these backup devices for like saving all your phone information, because they just like emotionally destroyed if they lose their phone, because everything was on it. You know, it's like having a stroke. The information's all gone.
Exactly. And actually, you met another life blogger, not Gordon Bell, who actually went through a kind of digital stroke, a crash of his computer.
Yeah, he lost about 4 months.
Who is this?
This is Jim Gemmell, and he is one of the software engineers who works along with Gordon on essentially trying to figure out ways to sift through Gordon's enormous decades of memories. And so Jim decided, you know, as he developed the software, that he would do it himself. He would start doing his own life logging. And he showed me. It's wonderful. He's got some amazing things. Trips he's taken with his kids and some really wonderful stuff that is very emotionally touching. But what happened was that he had a crash and he lost about 4 months of it. And up until then, he had sort of thought, well, this is just this funny little experiment. I'm doing it to sort of learn how to make the software. I don't really rely on the stuff. But once the information was gone, he realized that he did rely on it, that it was like hot water or lights in his house. And then when he lost it, he felt absolutely bereft.
Now, losing that day at the beach you spent back in April, I mean, your brain was still working then, wasn't it? Don't you still have it?
Yeah, theoretically. The workings of human memory are very... very complex. Psychologists are as yet uncertain as to what the effect of all this virtual memory will be. Will it really be true that we'll sort of stop remembering things? Or will it release us to remember things in different ways? Or in some cases, will it make our memories better? Because the one thing that some scientists found in Ireland, they took Gordon's camera that he wears around his neck. It takes pictures every minute or so all day long. And, you know, so he's got thousands and thousands and thousands of these pictures. And you think, well, what are you ever going to do with those? You're never going to look at them again, right? What these guys in Ireland discovered was that if at the end of the day, you look at all those pictures, just blah, 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 really quickly scroll through them in about a minute, you relive your day as seen out your eyes, and it dramatically improves your long-term recall of what happened.
And this has been applied to people who are afflicted with short-term memory impairment, right?
That's right. That's right. This has been done with a woman in England who has a very severe form of amnesia. She really has no recall past a day or two. And so what she started doing was that every time there was something that she wanted to remember, a dinner with her husband, perhaps, she would make sure that she wore this camera. And then after the event was over, she would review the images every day for a couple of days. And she started being able to remember this stuff. It would last for months.
And you can really see the value of it in that case.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
I guess I still find puzzling why we need this kind of recall in our everyday life. Unless you believe, as many people do, that really all we are our memories. Are we fuller, more complete people if we can hold on to that stuff?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think that what's going to happen is that people will sort of make decisions about what type of memory they want to have. You might decide that, you know, I'm actually someone who just wants to see that one perfect picture from last summer. The sort of classic shoebox idea, where by the time you're 60, you've got a shoebox full of pictures, and that's all you've got. These little snapshots that represent an entire year in your life, and when you look at it, you recall everything, and it's a really majestic, almost poetic way of looking at your life, and you'll find other people who really want to have everything there. I think some people might choose to record a lot of stuff and then realize later on that, my God, why did I do this? You know, in the same way that some kids are discovering now that all the stuff they put on their websites is being Googled by their employers. So, you know, we'll make decisions about what type of memories we want to have. And in some cases, the decisions will be taken out of our hands. And that's where things get troubling, potentially.
Privacy then becomes a huge issue, doesn't it?
Sure.
There are certain things we'd all rather not remember. If you're engaged with, you know, one or two other people, one of them's bound to have it on tape.
That's right. But I think there's also a sort of a very weird form of privacy when you have this automatic recording capability, which is privacy from yourself. There's parts of your life that maybe you shouldn't remember. And making sense of your life is as much about forgetting the vast majority of it or subtly distorting it as it is perfectly remembering it. Any psychologist would tell you that forgetting is an incredibly important part of how we make sense of ourselves and our lives. And being able to re-experience directly everything might be sort of nightmarish. And the very few times that psychologists have encountered people with absolutely perfect recall, and it has been found, it's very rare, sort of a mental condition where people literally can, if you ask them, 2 years ago on this day, what did you do? They'll be able to tell you. These people do not have remarkable lives in any way. You would think that they're smarter or that they did better at college, and they're not. And they don't necessarily have a better emotional experience of their lives. The idea of remembering everything, it might not be as much of a gift as we think it would be.
Clive, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Clive Thompson covers technology for a number of national magazines, and he's a contributing writer for Fast Company magazine, and he has his own blog called collisiondetection.net.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Paul Schneider. We also had help from Jessica McGowdy and Ian Whitehead. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Catcher Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, offering a new one-year Master of Arts degree program for experienced journalists. Journalism.columbia.edu. And live from Lincoln Center, broadcasting I Can't Believe It's Schoenberg with Rob Capello and members of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center on January 10th. Broadcast times are available through local PBS listings. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.